Hello everyone, it's March 26, 2024, so we're a little late getting on the Starship Flight Test 3 analysis bandwagon, but we're going to do it anyway. It was good to see that progress was made. Hot staging went smoothly, everything after, not quite as much. Well, let's do some post-launch armchair analysis and speculation, and liftoff! Hey, before the tower, welcome to episode 452 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
And I'm Dennis.
Okay, so we two are back. Ben's still out. you were sick last week. But yeah, Ben's recovering from his long trip to Alabama. I guess just at the top of the show, I just wanted to talk about something that maybe other people have already seen, which is this new SpaceX launch escape chute, the Red Chute, which is really interesting looking. So this is with their new, I think this is being set up at, what is it, Slick 40?
Well, they're like only recently starting to outfit Slick 40 for crewed launches. So maybe that's why this is being showed. Because they've been flying people out of 39A. So, okay, so this is Slick 40.
Yeah. It just looks like an amusement park ride. It's like it looks just like a water slide, except there's no water. And it's a big fabric red chute. And when you look at it from the inside, because, you know, there's a video of what it looks like, it just looks like an amusement park ride. Or it really, for some reason, I guess because I see a pair of space boots, it kind of reminds me of a scene from 2001.
it does have like that 2001 color. Yeah. Yeah, it's got that very HAL red.
Right, exactly. Yeah, HAL red. Red and black. It's a quick way to get off of a rocket, but there's just something inherently kind of funny about that, no matter how you do it, I think. Because, I mean, what we were talking about a couple months ago, using the rail car method, which just looks like a roller coaster, I think any way of escaping from the top of a rocket is just going to look like an amusement park ride. Like, you can't help that.
Whether it's a basket, roller coaster, or this thing, which isn't always there, right? They first, like, release the fabric tube. Like, they have to deploy it before you go sliding through it, which I think is just worth noting. But yeah, it combines my two favorite things, terrifying heights and confined spaces. And so when Andrew Z emailed us this, my response to him was just a long nope. I would much rather take I would go basket, roller coaster, and then this slide. This slide terrifies me.
The Starship third flight test. We're, you know, a little bit behind because we should have been talking about this last episode, but really, I mean, not much is changed, and I was kind of hoping it would. So I guess, yeah, we totally could have talked about it last week and nothing would have changed. So we're basically just going to, you know, like cover those points. So there has not been much of an update, but, well, first of all, so did you watch it when it launched? Cause I actually missed it by a couple minutes, but I did watch it once the Starship was separated and it was in orbit. And I guess many people are disputing that, but yeah, I think we can safely say that it was in orbit. It just, was not in a permanent orbit.
Yeah, no, I it was a little early here, so I missed the launch, but I did catch it while it was still on its suborbital trajectory, but with orbital velocity.
Or I think maybe it was like, what, just a couple, maybe the speed, it was just shy. I can't remember. Or maybe it was, I do remember Scott Manley saying that he qualified it as an orbit because if you take the semi-major axis, that's orbital. Like, so that was kind of like his definition.
Okay.
but I think the velocity maybe was just a few, just shy. Like, maybe they needed a little bit more push. But of course, it was put on this trajectory very much intentionally, just in case they couldn't, you know, relight the engines, which they were not able to do. And we'll talk about that. So, but anyway, yeah, I guess we should start at the top here. One cool fact that I read that I didn't know about was that they did upgrade the tanking procedure. So now it takes less time to fill the massive booster and the booster and the Starship. I don't have in the notes how long it took the Starship to be loaded previously, but right now it's at 45 minutes. And I assume that it was longer, but the booster, used to take a little over like an hour and a half in order to load that with the prop, but now it just takes 53 minutes. So they've actually improved that substantially, which is really cool. So some sort of new procedure. But yeah, 53 minutes is good because that way you can probably save on the boil off that you would get by having to take a longer time to actually completely fill that tank. So, but yeah, so on the liftoff, so all 33 Raptor engines lit. So that's awesome. Do you remember last test if all of them lit or if it was just some of them? Because I mean, it lost some pretty quickly, right?
So IFT2, first stage did well. It's just that the hot SEP kind of worked But then the booster blew up within like 10 seconds afterwards. And so.
Right. Yeah. And that was due to an oxygen venting problem, which they have since fixed. So that was one less thing to worry about. So this time there was a successful booster separation. That was awesome. And so, yeah. So it cuts down to the three central engines just to give it a little bit less thrust so that that second stage can actually separate. And then they do the hot staging. And I think all that went great as far as I can tell. There was problems bringing the booster back, but I don't think that that was related to the staging. So at least that's one problem down. They made it a little bit further. So for the boost back of that first stage, there was a relight of 13 of the Raptors, which is the correct amount. But then the subsequent shutdown, right? That seems a little bit odd. And this is what I was hoping for more information on. There still hasn't been any. Was that intentional or not? Because it looked like if you're looking at the diagram, you see the right side of that, the little booster diagram, that shuts down. And then a couple seconds later, I think the left side does. So maybe this was, you know, to maybe rotate the booster or something like that. I mean, we just don't know. And it possibly could have been a telemetry problem. So maybe it all went nominally and it just looked like that. Although I imagine that's something that maybe could have been visible from the ground. Yeah, I think so. So yeah, they went down to three engines for staging, and then there was the relight for boost back. That looked normal. Around the 30,000 foot mark, the first stage got a little bit unstable, and you can really see the grid fins struggling. And maybe that was, you know, high winds at that level. Not sure. This too is something that I wish we had more information on, but I don't think that that was normal for a first stage to, you know, react in that way. It might just be that it needed to shed more velocity before it got to that point. I think that was one possibility that was put forward. So they might need to change that re-entry. But yeah, I mean, it was just like the grid fins, which are massive, like, by the way. So to see them moving that quickly, you have to think that you're like moving something that big. I don't know how many thousands of pounds that weighs, but they're just, you know, turning 90 degrees within a second or two.
Yeah, and it's going well in excess of 1,000 kilometers an hour at that point.
Yeah. And and so this is when it tries to do the relight. And that was an incomplete relight of those engines. And the thought is that that was possibly due to a fuel slosh because of, you know, the unstable booster itself. So basically, you have to have the booster plus the Starship also. And I imagine this goes for all rockets. Like, you have to make sure that the rocket is stable before you can relight the engines, because you have to make sure that the fuel is, you know, down there towards the inlets. Yeah. So for the landing, only three Raptors relit. And I think that that's how many would be lit, right, for the very final descent, but it didn't make it that far.
So, right, there's the three rings, right? There's the inner three, and then I guess, what's that, 10 around them? And then there's the outer ring. And those inner ones can all gimbal. I remember them saying that. But I think when you see it try to restart them for the landing, splashdown, there are ones in the, yeah, so in that 10, that intermediate ring. So that's why I thought it'd be, I guess, the 13 that launched. Is that what you mean by when you say the inner engines? You mean all 13 inner engines or just three inner engines?
So for the boost back, all the 13, so it's 10 plus the 3 mil. Yeah, so the 13 engines relit just fine. Then you have all of them shut down, but it shuts down in a kind of asymmetric way. And that's one thing that we don't know if that's intentional or not. Uh-huh. They kind of go off in what looks kind of like a random fashion, but mostly one side, then the other. And then it's basically on a ballistic trajectory, making some adjustments with little RCS thrusters. And then, yeah, you have a partial relay on some of those 13, but not many. And then we lose the signal and it's just gone. So not much of a relay at all, actually. I'm watching the video right now trying to see how many maximum relit, but I think it was only like two.
I think there was briefly three for a second, but really it was just two that were firing, it seemed.
But yeah, that's only for a second. Then it's back down to two. Yeah, not very successful on that booster landing, but more successful than the previous test flight. So the signal was lost around the 2 kilometer altitude mark, and that was that. And yeah, and the splashdown was apparently 1,000 meters per second, so it should be more like 8. So that's a big difference. It came in way too fast, but I haven't seen any video of that. If there has been any captured, not sure that there was. I think that there was some speculation that maybe somebody had a drone or someone was in a helicopter. Who knows? I haven't seen that yet, though. That would be cool to see. But so I guess we can move on to Starship. So the part that did make it to orbit, there was a couple of tests that they had done. One was a propellant transfer. And as far as I know, that went great. The objective was to transfer 10 tons from the header tank to the main oxidizer tank. And they were successful. So good job. Then the PEZ door, that had some issues. It had some issues opening, and it looked like closing as well. Now, I'm not the best at visual inspection of something, but that's what it looked like to me. There's been other comments saying the same thing. And you could definitely see that there was some internal atmosphere, so it was actually internally pressurized. And I'm sure that there are vents built in that are meant to vent any, you know, atmosphere inside, but I guess they didn't, you know, work, or they weren't able to vent fast enough. Maybe there was some issue there. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a big design flaw. Who knows? Yeah. So it's probably that the door couldn't open properly because it had a lot of, you know, pressure trying to push it open. So it's not able to move correctly. But otherwise, the door seemed to work right. They just need to fix that pressure differential problem. And then the next objective was to relight the engines, but that didn't happen. And the thought is possibly fuel slosh, which wouldn't be surprising given how much of a tumble or a roll the Starship was in. So moving on to that, I wanted to, and we'll have the link in the show notes, someone on Twitter, I'm not familiar with this particular, or X, with this particular account, Pokken, P-O-C-K-N, they did a great little animation of Starship because you can see the camera, which, by the way, that was one cool thing about this launch. A lot of cameras on board Starship and the booster. You get to see what it looks like from that perspective. But as for Starship, you know, since it was rolling so much, it's hard to get an idea of exactly what's going on because it's very, you know, it's just very disorienting. So what they did was they actually corrected for this by using that camera footage and showing just how that roll was happening. And at one point, it also goes from a forward-facing position to the opposite direction. So basically, it has the engines that are coming in first, which is very much not the orientation you want when you're re-entering the atmosphere. Plus, it was upside down. That's also not good. I mean, it was just doing everything. And the camera was fixed to the forward fin, and it was basically looking down the body of the rocket towards the engines and thus towards the Earth. But yeah, and so it starts to pick up some heating, and you can see one of those fins turning red. So yeah, that's the entry interface, and you got a lot of plasma there. But at that point, it was basically on its side. Then it turns onto its belly. Then I think it turns over again, and it's basically upside down. I mean, this thing is taking plasma on all sides of the vehicle, and I'm kind of amazed that it survived as long as it did. Yeah, they just had no control there. One little visual thing that you can see that was pointed out is that there is a LOX roll vent that should have been trying to correct for that roll, and it was not. So maybe that was the problem, that they weren't able to control the roll because of those LOX vents not operating. And that probably is the case, because obviously they weren't able to take out the roll. So some kind of a LOX vent problem. And these are the vents that are built, I guess, kind of sort of into the LOX tank. They basically vent the liquid oxygen, and you can do so in any direction you want because it's a series of you know, vents that are actually directed along the XYZ axis. Like you can do, you know, like you can roll it or move it in any direction you want to.
So, okay. So what they said, they were looking at, they were analyzing stuff, and they basically said that, like, it looked like there was some roll that was imparted, probably on purpose, during the propellant transfer test, like beforehand. But then after that test, it spun up. And so they think that that propellant transfer might have been what screwed up the roll, essentially, so that, you know, it wasn't able to zero it out before hitting the atmosphere.
So you mean like the transfer of propellant
put a torque, yeah, or rather, yeah, just kind of shifted, yeah, shifted the moment of inertia, I guess, of the spacecraft.
Interesting, okay.
Because, and if someone had asked, like, well, if it's just axial, why wouldn't, like, how does that, you know, give you any kind of, like, why would that change any rotation along that axis? But then some people were showing diagrams that it might not have been along the axis, like, it might not have been along the central axis of the vehicle, but kind of off to the side. And so by doing the transfer, you could have, you know, weighted one side of the vehicle or put some internal forces that caused it to spin up.
That's totally possible, yeah.
Let's see if that shows up on Space News in a week or two.
Right. Well, that's, yeah. I mean, that's interesting. And I mean, I think Starship still should have been able to correct for it with the cold gas thrusters, but that could be the cause of it.
Sure. Yeah, because I thought it was more, it seemed like it was more of a tumble when I was watching it, but like, I guess, I don't know, from that video you showed, or that Twitter video that you showed, it doesn't look like it's a tumble so much as a roll. Because I could see them not being able to recover from a tumble, but not being able to recover from a roll just because it was spinning a little too fast, like faster than you thought it would. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You just fire thrusters longer, but I guess if the vents aren't working, the thrusters aren't working then. I don't know.
And it's also at this point, right around this point, that you see a lot of debris coming off of the vehicle. No idea what that is. I looked. I can't figure it out. It looks like ice or chunks of something. And if it's not ice, I'm guessing tiles. That seems to be the only two things it could be. Yeah. It did lose some tiles. So I don't know how many. I don't know the exact number, but it can clearly be seen on the camera there mounted on the vehicle that some of the tiles did not make it to orbit. What this was, I'm not sure. And at this altitude, it probably wasn't due to the atmosphere just yet. So it looks like maybe it was being blown off by a thruster trying to fire.
Can I ask, I'm just curious, like, is this that plasma building up on the one fin was so cool. Is this the first time we've ever had an external view of plasma building up on a spacecraft, like re-entering?
Yes, that's a good point. I think it is. It's not the first time getting a view.
Well, it's windows, I know.
Right. Yeah, from like windows. And it's definitely the first time that we're seeing it live, because that wouldn't be possible. Normally, it's not possible because of the plasma. But I think what everyone's thinking is just that Starship's so big that it kind of creates a little bit of a signal wake, you know, so that you can actually beam back up to a TDRS or Starlink satellite. And it was communicating with both of those. So yeah, that was very cool to see. Yeah, the first time from the outside of the spacecraft, no less. How cool is that?
Yeah.
And so those fins became pretty visibly hot around 100 kilometers. And then, yeah, like I said, the angle of attack, it pretty much reverses. So it's coming in butt first. Then I think maybe it goes back. Hard to keep track. It's, you know, just basically at this point tumbling all over the place. It's right around then that the signal is lost, both with TDRS and Starlink. So most likely it broke up because if not, then you'd think it would have maintained the link with one, and then it would have lost with the other one. So most likely that's when the vehicle broke up, which, like I said, it's not surprising just given how it was kind of like barbecue rolling, but not in a good way. It was just getting toasty on all sides. Yeah, and that reentry point, I guess, was somewhere over the Indian Ocean. They were expecting to have it come down not too far off the northwest coast of Australia in the Indian Ocean. But yeah, so the next attempt apparently is going to be maybe in the next 6 weeks. And this is according to Gwynne Shotwell. I think she was at some talk, and that is the information that she released. But there will be no Starlink payload, because they do plan on maybe doing some Starlink deployments on some of the later tests, I think, once they've worked out at least getting the Starship portion down. Like, maybe you can't bring the booster back, but that's fine. You can still deploy some of those big Starlinks. But that won't be happening on this next test. And yeah, and the last thing that I thought was surprising is that they are planning on 6 more flights by the end of this year. That's a lot. So we've got like roughly 9 more months to go, or 8, I guess. And they want to do 6 more flights. So they're really picking up the pace here. That's impressive.
I mean, that would be impressive, but I will take bets that they will not fly 6 more times in 2024.
I mean, probably not. But I mean, if they do 4 or 5, that's still pretty impressive.
Oh, yeah.
It seems at this point, because they are building starships and boosters, it's really just a matter of getting the – you have to get the clearance, but otherwise, I think they would probably be ready, you know. I think they have a pretty good idea of how to fix what went wrong and then take the next step. They just need to get the go-ahead. But I think there's a pretty good chance next launch, hopefully in 6 weeks, we'll see the first stage – at least make it to just off the coast, where it will hopefully splash down at 8 kilometers per second and not 1,000.
Yeah, no, I agree with you totally. If they were operating in a vacuum, I'm sure they could launch 6 more by the end of the year. But yeah, given the other realities you pointed out. But yeah, every Starship launch has been exciting so far, and I don't see why the next one wouldn't be. So looking forward to it.
All right, so let's do 3 short and sweets this week. What's the first one, Dennis?
First up, Euclid spacecraft addresses ice buildup on optics. Once space observatories reach orbit, they often find that water once absorbed from the air during assembly on Earth is outgassed and builds up as an icy deposit on spacecraft optics. The Euclid Science Operations team has noticed a steady decline in stellar brightness measured with the telescope's visible instrument, demonstrating this icing behavior. While a common issue for spacecraft, the European Observatory requires remarkable precision for its mapping of the universe, and operations have begun to de-ice its optics. Onboard heaters and sunlight remove most water when Euclid first reached orbit, but to deal with the current ice buildup, mission managers will heat up individual mirrors one at a time, hoping this will allow the spacecraft to complete its 6-year survey with its required precision.
Then next up, the Ariane 6 is coming together. The first and second stages of the new Ariane 6 rocket have been joined in the vehicle assembly building at Europe's spaceport in French Guiana. The two stages were horizontally integrated, but will be raised vertically once moved to the new Ariane 6 launch pad, where the vehicle's side boosters will be integrated. The payloads and fairing will then be integrated in the following months in preparation for the vehicle's expected launch in June.
And finally, Soyuz aborts at the pad. Last week, MS-25's Soyuz rocket, with Russian Oleg Novitsky, Belarusian Marina Vasilevskaya, and American Tracy Caldwell Dyson on board, suffered a rare last-minute scrub, with the abort called due to a low voltage reading in the vehicle. After first stage batteries were swapped, the launch was able to proceed, although the delay meant that the crew would have to take the longer 2-day approach to station rather than the fast 3-hour trajectory. The record-breaking scrub had occurred later in the countdown than in any other crewed Soyuz before.
All right, so let's move on to This Week in Spaceflight History. We have no winners this week due to we got their date wrong again. That keeps happening. This, I think, was a week when maybe we didn't have somebody verify, because we do have somebody to check up on that for us, and we didn't do that this time. And sure enough, when you know it, we got the wrong year. The clue was dry, wet, and lumpy, and we gave the date as being in 2017, but it should have been in 2002. But anyway, yes, so Dennis, what was the dry, wet, and lumpy event that happened in space?
Well, quickly, just a shout out to Cy Kyle for a wonderful guess of a different event that he was able to describe as dry, wet, and lumpy. But specifically for This Week in Spaceflight History, we're talking about the 17th of March 2002, and that was the launch of the GRACE spacecraft. And so GRACE is a pretty awesome spacecraft. It's a pretty cool mission, pretty straightforward to understand, but it's also very powerful. And more than some other, you know, spacecraft and missions that we talk about, this one has kind of gotten into the public consciousness a bit more because of the types of measurements that it made. And so in any event, GRACE stands for the Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. And it's again, a pretty interesting setup. It's a pair of spacecraft that were launched together that collectively make GRACE. They're called GRACE 1 and GRACE 2. They're nicknamed Tom and Jerry. And so these in 2002 were launched to orbit on a Rokot, Russian launch vehicle. You know how much we love etymology and languages on the show. And so, David, it sounds like Rokot is not this, what looks like Rokot, R-O-K-O-T or R-O-C-K-O-T. You might think, okay, well, that's how you say rocket in, you know, in Russian, but it's translated more like rumble. And when I go and I look at the etymology of the English word rocket, it comes from some Italian about like being like thin and cylindrical, I think. So nothing to do with rumble. So it's not even like they have a shared lineage together. I think this is just a remarkably bizarre coincidence that the word for rumble, which rockets rumble, yeah, looks like rocket in English.
And it's interesting because I like learning the etymology words, and I never thought to look up rocket. I don't know why. So thanks for bringing that up. I'm looking at it now.
Sure.
Why did I never look up rocket? Yeah. Such an obvious word.
Yeah. So these were, you know, older vehicles, basically. I mean, I could be getting the history wrong, but if I remember or have the correct sense, this was kind of when Russia was taking a lot of their ICBMs and then trying to sell them as commercial vehicles. And so Rokot, I believe, was one of those. And so, yeah. But in any event, in, you know, March of 2002, it launched from Plesetsk, and it was taken to an 89-degree inclination, 500-ish kilometer orbit. And so this isn't sun synchronous. This is just a polar orbit, right? Within 1 degree of just going over the poles and straight down. And it's because of what it was trying to do. It was, like I said, it was a pair of spacecraft, that were, they had these trapezoid shapes. I had to look up, apparently the word for a 3-dimensional trapezoid is a trapezoidal prism. And so that's how you can kind of think of these. They're these long, you know, projected trapezoids, essentially, each spacecraft. And if this might be a bit of a stretch for a reference, but if you remember playing the game Excitebike for NES, it's basically shaped like the speed bumps in Excitebike. which you would encounter, or you could, like, when you make your own map or your own track. It's, I think those qualify as trapezoidal prisms. But the reason why they wanted it to be polar, and the reason why you needed a pair of them, is because they had an instrument that would do K-band microwave ranging between the two spacecraft that are otherwise in the same orbit, just different phases, you know, one's in front of the other. And they would do this to detect gravity anomalies. And so, right, performing gravimetry. And that's because with that, you know, distance known, if you can measure the distance between them accurately, then as they pass over, you know, part of the Earth that has, you know, a slightly higher gravity, like a, let's say, a mountain, the spacecraft that, you know, passes over it first is going to be pulled forward relative to the other. So the separation increases. And then when the second spacecraft passes over it, it then gets kind of heaved forward from the force of gravity and reduces that distance again. And so this is normally, you know, it's a very small kind of actual change in separation, but it's enough to be measured using interferometry, which is what you want to do whenever you want to make very, very, very precise measurements. you measure wavelengths essentially interfering and canceling out with each other, or at least not being slightly out of phase, and then you can measure that very accurately.
Does that mean that these two satellites are very, I mean, you'd think that they're kept in a perfect relative position to one another, but if that's not possible, or, and I don't know if it is, but if not, then do they just account for that and then you just measure the difference?
Good question. So So having not seen anything about, you know, there's no onboard propulsion or anything like that to kind of station keep to maintain things like this. And what there is, though, are among the various instruments on board, accelerometers and star trackers and things to very accurately characterize the spacecraft separation. And something that, I mean, I'd never really thought about this, although in retrospect, you know, I suppose it's obvious, but I always think of, okay, I always kind of visualize, you know, these two spacecraft in, like, doing one arc of one orbit, and then there's that change in separation. That's how they can make that measurement. But what's really cool about them is that, you know, it basically takes about a month for them to do the full Earth and start to revisit places. And so the same bulk scale gravity anomalies are going to be there, you know, month after month after month, right? You're going to have still roughly the same, you know, Palisades in North Jersey. But, like, when, you know, ice sheets are changing, right? When rivers are, you know, maybe lake sea level is dropping in certain places, different things like that. Basically, the water change in particular, they can make those measurements and see those changes over time, specifically. And so that's kind of really what it's for. Is the kind of two main things were to characterize the, you know, the gravitational anomalies of the Earth globally, and that's again why you want that 90-degree-ish inclination. But then to also make temporal measurements of how the water of the Earth is basically changing between different phases as it, you know, as ice melts and, you know, ocean and lakes evaporate and things like that, to be able to actually pick that out. How much moisture is in the soil over, you know, an area the size of, you know, hundreds of thousands of square miles or whatever. So, yeah. So really cool. And that's where the clue comes in, why, you know, dry, wet, and lumpy. Where it's really, you know, it's got the lumpiness of the gravitational field and it's measuring these dry gravitational anomalies as well as the wet ones that I'm just talking about, the water changing phase and, you know, melting and basically being displaced in different places. And so these this is not a purely NASA mission. This is a NASA and DLR joint mission, the German Space Agency. And so the spacecraft themselves were actually built by Astrium using their what's called their FlexBus satellite bus. And so this is a German company, and they had a what looked like a forerunner named Champ, which was doing different things. It was a solo spacecraft, but it had that same trapezoidal prism shaped. And then they built the pair of Grace. And so these measurements, again, they were done with this microwave ranging system. It was called the KBR or K-band ranging system. And they could measure things like ice sheet loss, ocean bottom pressure, isostatic rebound, which is a fun one. So, like, you have ice sheets, you know, tens of thousands of years ago that were basically weighing down, if they're kilometers thick, weighing down on the crust underneath them. And then as they melt, that crust over tens of thousands of years is rebounding back up. And so that's a cause of, you know, different changes in sea level in certain places on Earth. And as you kind of mentioned before, the K-band ranging system wasn't the only thing that it had on board. It had a bunch of other instruments that were involved, mostly to characterize the spacecraft separation so that they could make very, very, very highly accurate measurements. And so they were, from what I read, they were able to get 10 micron accuracy. And so with a 220 kilometer separation, if I'm doing my math right, that's one in 100 billion. So approaching like the trillionths level of accuracy, which is quite good. And so this spacecraft was, you know, doing its business and doing a great job until Grace 2's battery failed. I assume this is the Jerry out of the Tom and Jerry pair. I'm not certain. And it wound up deorbiting in December of 2017. And Grace 1 followed its demise in March of 2018. And so that was the end of the Grace spacecraft. And there was a couple-year gap, which you can see in a lot of the public data, in particular the ice sheets. But this pair of spacecraft did a great job, and they resulted in a follow-up mission that was launched on the 22nd of May, 2018, that I'm sure we talked about when it launched. And that was the Grace follow-on. Grace FO is the name of it, Grace-FO. And so it was launched on a Falcon 9 in 2018. And these are some of the most iconic pictures you see that'll be published in the media or appearing on social media, appearing in print media as well as, you know, maybe on TV. Whenever they show you the ice sheets changing, you can just literally Google NASA ice sheets and it's going to show you Grace data. Take it to the website that shows you the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets and all the thousands of gigatons of ice that have been lost since the spacecraft was taking measurements in 2002. And you can even see the gap between Grace and Grace follow-on in, you know, the 2017 to 2018 era. And so Grace follow-on, it's still in orbit, still flying over us, you know, every month. One of the big upgrades to that one is that they're using laser interferometry. In addition to upgraded avionics, it's still the same wonderful little trapezoids on orbit. Are there plans, you might be asking, for a future one after that? And hopefully one that it seems like NASA is very serious about not letting another gap happen, because in 2028 or later, they're planning to launch Grace C, where C stands for continuity. And so this will be, again, another pair of the trapezoids. I think it'll also have the optical, or I'm actually not certain that's optical, but the laser interferometer to measure the spacecraft relative positions and separation. And yeah, and the fact that it's got continuity in the name means I think they want to not let another, you know, 2017 gap occur again. And then the last thing I'll say, because this was, you know, intended to be the TWSIF for the TWSIF to be presented last week at the last episode, which we didn't do when we you guys did that wonderful interview with Dante Loretta, is that the GRAIL mission that was launched in 2011 did the same principle, the same type of gravimetry, but around the moon. So that's pretty cool. It's, you know, it's a GRACE-like mission, and, you know, I'm sure it learned and built on a lot of things that Grace figured out. But what made it topical to the Dante Loretta interview is that it was GRAIL was the discovery mission that beat OSIRIS before OSIRIS became OSIRIS-REx, and it was fighting for these discovery missions. It lost out to GRAIL in 2011. So yeah, and then they, you know, they started they announced new frontier missions, and then they were like, "Ooh, well, let's make OSIRIS but even bigger." And so OSIRIS-REx was born. But in any event, that was this week in spaceflight history.
Awesome. This week in spaceflight history. Always good to hear about satellites that measure gravity. I feel like we've done a lot of those. They always find interesting things about the Earth. I mean, assuming that it's the Earth or the Moon, just like whatever you choose to measure. So moving on to the event for next week. The date range is the 2nd through the 8th of April. Dennis, do you have a clue for us on behalf of Ben?
Yes, I do. Next week in 1965. Catching geoworms.
Sounds like, that sounds weird.
Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, yeah. You'll have to figure out.
Sounds like something you need like a Yeah, like antibiotics for
it. Yeah, but you could either need antibiotics for it, or you're just a kid playing around the mud catching geoworms. I don't know.
Okay, well, if you have a guess as to what this clue is referencing, you can email us at info@theorbitalmechanics.com or shoot us a toot on Mastodon, and you can use the hashtag ThisWeekSF, or you can visit theorbitalmechanics.com/Discord for an invite to our Discord server and type /TwistSF or TWSF to hand your guess directly to our Tombot. And good luck.
Good luck, everybody.
So let's move on to upcoming spaceflight events, and thank you to Launch Library 2, which is where we start our research each week. We have, I think, 7 launches, so a lot. What's the first one, Dennis?
7 events, at least, but yeah.
Yeah, 7 events, 6 launches. Okay, yep.
Yeah, and so first up, we've got on Tuesday, March 26th, a Long March 6C, which is one of CASC's rockets, and this will be taking an unknown payload. If I understand this, if I'm reading this correctly, this 6C, this will be the first flight of this particular variant of a Long March 6. So there's Long March 6s and 6As, but the 6C, this looks like it'll be its first launch. And so in any event, again, that's Tuesday, March 26th, with a window from 2242 to 2336. That's based on NOTAMs, and it will be flying out of Taiwan Satellite Launch Center.
Next up, on the 28th, we have the launch of Starlink Group 718. So it's another Falcon 9 Block 5 launching from Vandenberg Space Force Base. So this is cool. Space Launch Complex 4E. And the time for that, like I said, the 28th from 0230 UTC through 0701 UTC. So a big launch window there for this, I guess, somewhat polar batch of Starlinks.
Yeah, hoping to catch that one myself. And then we've already had a first flight, and now we will have a last flight. And so Thursday, March 28th, we've got the final flight of the Delta IV Heavy, ULA's big old rocket. And so this will be taking NROL 70, which, as you can imagine, is classified. And again, that launch will be on Thursday, March 28th, with a window from 1740 to 2251 UTC, flying out of the Cape at Slick 37B.
All right. So after that, on the 29th, we have another Starlink group. This is group 645 on another Falcon 9 Block 5, this time launching from Slick 40 at the Cape. So yeah, launching from a different place. Launch date and time for that on the 29th from 2100 UTC through 0100 the next day. Pretty late. Well, I guess it's like early evening if you're in the States. So yeah, I guess check that one out if you like.
And then on Saturday at March 30th, we have a Soyuz 21B. And so this will be taking a resource, which I believe means resource, resource P number 4, Earth observation satellite, and it'll be taking it to sun synchronous, as Earth observing satellites often like to go because of the lighting conditions. And therefore, it has this instantaneous window again on Saturday, March 30th at 0936 UTC, and it'll be launching out of Baikonur at site 31-6.
Also on the 30th, we have another Falcon 9. I'm just doing all the Falcon 9s today.
I know, right?
or almost, I think. Yeah, I think I'm getting them all. So this is Falcon 9 Block 5. It's launching Eutelsat 36D. So it's a new generation multi-mission geostationary telecommunications satellite. It'll be at 36 degrees east for TV broadcasting and such. Launching from Kennedy Space Center Launch Complex 39A. And the launch time for that on the 30th is 2200 UTC through 0100 UTC the following day. So, yep, another Falcon 9.
And then finally, we have our people event, our non-launch of the week. And so over April 1st and 2nd, there will be a series of events on NASA TV covering, ultimately, the departure of Soyuz MS-24. So that'll include the hatch closing, the undocking, the deorbit, and the landing. So on the spacecraft will be Oleg Novitsky and Marina Vasilevskaya, who were on the, you know, the launch that we just talked about. They're only going to be on board for 12 days, and they're going to be bringing Laurel O'Hara, a NASA astronaut, back after about 200 days on orbit. And so specifically on Monday, April 1st at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, There'll be coverage of the farewells and hatch closing, with the hatch closing itself scheduled for approximately 9:55 p.m. And then on Tuesday, April 2nd at 1 a.m. Eastern, coverage of the undocking of the spacecraft will take place on NASA TV, with the undocking itself scheduled for 1:31 a.m. And then a couple hours later at 3:45 a.m. Eastern, we'll have coverage of the deorbit burn and landing of the spacecraft near Jiazkazgan, Kazakhstan. The deorbit burn is scheduled for 4:03 a.m. and the landing scheduled for 4:57 a.m. So at least they won't be spending 2 days after undocking before landing. So a quicker trip down than the trip up. So those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
A whole bunch of them. So that means it's time then to deal with the show. And we would like to thank Ron Jenkins and Tim Dodd for our music.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
We record live on Sundays at 9 a.m. Pacific time and 12 p.m. Eastern. And thank you so much to Dennis O, Mr. Cesium, Mike Collin, Leon Running Man, and Chubby for joining our recording session today and helping us make correction burns on the fly.
If you want to support the show, please tell a friend, or better yet, leave us a review or wherever you listen. You can also visit theorbitalmechanics.com/support for our Patreon campaign and affiliate links.
And get in touch. Find links to our mailing list, Discord server, and Mastodon account at theorbitalmechanics.com/about, or you can skip all that by emailing info@theorbitalmechanics.com. So that's it. We'll see you all next week on Orbit. Until then, later.
Goodbye, everybody, and see you.